Back in July, as Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, was walking off the stage at a press conference, a journalist cried out from the crowd.
Ah, no. ¿Quién te amenazó?
Eso sí.
Rodolfo Montes, a veteran independent journalist, was close to tears. His life had been threatened, he said, by a cartel calling itself the Jalisco New Generation. The president's press team had provided him with bodyguards, but now they had withdrawn that protection.
El mecanismo ahorita me está retirando las escoltas.
No.
Hoy a las 2 de la mañana, mi hija salió del país.
His daughter had to flee the country at 2 a.m. He suspected that the cartel was connected with a corrupt public official, that the government wasn't supporting him, but working against him. The president assured him that he would be safe.
Y tienes todo nuestro apoyo, no estás solo.
You have our full support, all our support, the president said. You are not alone. And those who are threatening, let them know that there is no impunity, that no one is protected, nobody. But Rodolfo could be forgiven for being skeptical. 5 other journalists have made similar pleas to President Obrador over the past few years. One of them was killed shortly thereafter. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr, and this is On Point. Mexico is the most dangerous place in the world to be a journalist. At least 15 journalists have been killed in Mexico this year. That's as many as have lost their lives in Ukraine this year, more than anywhere else in the world, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. The difference between Mexico and Ukraine, though, is that most of the journalists killed in Ukraine have died in crossfire. In Mexico, journalists are being killed deliberately, and they have been for 2 decades. Out of the more than 150 journalists killed in Mexico in the recent past, one murder stands out for its brutality, for the earnestness of the victim, and for the mystery behind it. The murder of Regina Martinez in April 2012. Catherine Corcoran served as the Associated Press Bureau Chief in Mexico City from 2010 to 2016. She wanted to get to the bottom of what happened to Regina and understand the forces that led to her killers walking free. She's the author of In the Mouth of the Wolf, A Murder, A Cover-Up, and the True Cost of Silencing the Press, out next month. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us on Point.
Hello, Kimberly. Thank you for having me.
So you said you didn't find this story about Regina. The story found you. What do you mean by that?
Well, when I became the bureau chief in Mexico City for the Associated Press in 2010, this, what I call an epidemic in journalist killings, was already underway. And at the time, it was 6 or 7 people a year, which was an extraordinary number at the time. As you pointed out, now it's more than double that. But as the bureau chief, as the director of news in that region, it was a story that we were living on 2 levels. First of all, we were covering these journalist killings. And second of all, even though the killings tended to be targeted toward local journalists and not foreign correspondents, not international news agencies like the Associated Press, it still changed the terrain in which we were reporting, and we had to consider our own security and our own measures for going out and reporting in Mexico in a way that we didn't have to before because of these killings. And so we were living it on these 2 levels as it was happening. And I was in charge of the security of the teams in the bureau.
So you knew that there was a danger posed, particularly by local journalists, but also others as well. But you call Regina's death the first clear case of silencing the free press. What do you mean by that?
Yes. When these killings started, there was a narrative that came out of the government that basically said that if a journalist was killed, it was because they were corrupt. It was because they were doing something wrong. They were colluding with the drug cartels. They were taking payments, and they somehow got crossways with these illicit forces that they were working for. And it was a very strong, constant narrative, and it worked. People started to repeat it because there were no real investigations of these cases. The government would come out almost immediately and say the journalist was killed because of something they were doing, like somehow it was their fault. And without a real clear investigation, we really didn't know. And then and clearly there were cases like that, but they would say all of them were that way, and we just really didn't know. And when Rahina was found dead, it was very clear that that wasn't the case. She was very well known for her ethics and her standards and her tenacity and the fact that she did report on things that the government didn't want people writing about. She was known as an uncomfortable journalist because she would go after subjects that nobody else would in terms of public corruption, abuse of authority, things like that. And so she had a very clear and strong reputation in that regard. So when she turned up dead, it was very clear that somebody was trying to silence her.
And help us understand the context of this. Journalists like Rahina, how do they do this kind of independent journalism in Mexico? Who protects them, or do they protect each other?
Well, they do protect each other. It was very difficult to do that kind of journalism in the era when she was working. She started her career in the 1980s and reported through the 1980s, 90s, 2000s, at a time where, even though Mexico was in a transition politically from one-party authoritarian rule to democracy and to democratically elected presidents and governors, etc., the press pretty much remained timid and followed in lockstep with the government's official story. And in Mexico City, the press was changing very much so to being more independent, more critical, the national press. But in the states, like the state where Rahina worked, it was Veracruz, which is a Gulf Coast state. In the provinces and the states, the journalism remained very official. And so for someone like her to go against the grain, she was not only a problem for the authorities and the powers that be, but even for her own colleagues. There was distrust of her for her own colleagues because they were colluding, they were in lockstep, they were likely taking payments from various politicians to write positive stories. And so for her, it was very difficult. She had to be very discreet. She was a very hermetic person. She didn't want people to know a lot about what she was working on or about her family or anyone who could become a target for someone who was trying to get to her. And so mainly in that time, she did rely on a small cadre of colleagues who also operated with the same ethics and standards and the same watchdog idea of what a journalist should be. And she also worked for a newspaper initially where the owner also wanted to change the type of journalism that was being done in Veracruz. So initially she was supported by her news director and the newspaper owner, also a small cadre of colleagues. But as time went on, she became more and more isolated in that type of work.
And talk a little bit more about the work she was doing at the time of her death. Who saw her as a threat?
Well, she had a long history of going up against the powers that be, and she had a history of harassment. For example, the government had stopped sending her press releases. They had barred her from some press conferences in retaliation for stories that she had written. Basically, what she covered, the interesting thing about Rahina and the other thing that made her case more clear-cut than the others is she did not cover drug cartels. She covered public corruption. And her her area, her specialty was social justice kinds of issues. Because again, she was reporting in an authoritarian government, and the press did not give voice to anyone in opposition, be it political people or the people being repressed or the victims of the government action. And so she really specialized in covering communities that didn't have a voice, such as the poor, indigenous people, laborers, farm workers, people who traditionally did not have a voice in the press in Mexico, as well as the opposition political parties. And so the fact that she went to these sources, got out of the office, went beyond the press releases, she was able to find out a lot of things that other reporters didn't know, and write things that reporters didn't know. But I would say that she was mainly uncomfortable to the politicians and the political system around the time of her death.
And how did she die?
She was beaten and strangled to death in her home, in her bathroom, in the middle of the night, it's believed, from a Friday night to a Saturday morning.
Catherine Corcoran, stay with us. We are talking about the danger that journalists face in Mexico, one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist, and the story of Regina Martinez. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and today we're looking at the murders of journalists in Mexico. 15 so far this year, more than anywhere else in the world. And we're looking at one death in particular, the 2012 murder of Regina Martinez, a journalist from the state of Veracruz. Catherine Corcoran is with me. She's the author of a new book about Regina's death, In the Mouth of the Wolf, A Murder, A Cover-Up, and the True Cost of Silencing the Press, out on October 18th. Regina was the Veracruz correspondent for a magazine called Proceso, a national political magazine based in Mexico City. Jorge Carrasco was her editor at the time, and he's now Proceso's editor-in-chief. He told us that, before she was killed, even Regina, a famously dogged reporter, had started to self-censor herself.
She was killed on April 2012, and the last conversation we had was in December 2011. And at that moment, she told me that the situation in Veracruz was so difficult. And that's why she decided not to make independent research because the situation was so difficult.
Rahina wasn't giving up on journalism, but she was steering clear of certain topics, especially of government and military corruption.
She told me that she wanted to write the economies, the social issues, but not security, because she told me that the military there was involved in criminal activities. And that's why she decided to stop any research on that.
But that decision didn't protect her. Her murder sent shockwaves through the Mexican media.
At that moment, there was no murder of a national correspondent. And that's why I say that the Regina's murder was a broken of the line. So at that moment, the news of the murders was limited to local reporters and not nationals. And so it was so shocking for us, for me in particular.
But instead of being scared, Jorge became determined. He went to Veracruz to investigate Rahina's murder. He published a piece about the tangled web of organized crime and local officials that had wanted her dead. Jorge made a name for himself.
When I write down that piece, I received a message from an anonymous source that told me, "I don't know what you write down, but the government of Veracruz is so ugly with you, and they decided to go for you at Mexico City."
The threats against Jorge were very real and very frightening.
I began to receive personal information about my address, about my educational background, and things like my driver licenses. So there were true evidence that I was target of this mix of authorities and criminals in Veracruz.
So Jorge left Mexico with family for a while, but even when he returned, he needed the protection of a bodyguard for several years. Catherine, Jorge talks about this mix of authorities and criminals that had targeted Rahina and then targeted him. What is this mixture? How do cartels and government work together in practice? And why are they so violent when they're threatened with being found out?
Well, this is, I would call it an unintended consequence of democracy in Mexico. When Mexico was under a one-party authoritarian rule, the president of Mexico controlled everything. He appointed the governors of the states. He controlled the party, and he also controlled, in a certain way, the mafias and the organized crime. There were sort of deals and treaties that allowed organized crime to operate, but with limitations like everything else in Mexico at the time, according to whatever the president said, or with whatever benefits the government could get out of that agreement. But the government was clearly in control. When Mexico moved to a democracy, it really decentralized the political power in the country. So the president, who became democratically elected, lost that centralized kind of power, and it trickled down to the state governors and the local municipalities. And the organized crime system also fractured and fell apart to the point where the mafias or the drug cartels were now making deals on a local level or a state level. And so whatever they worked out depended on the state or the politician. In some places, maybe they were outright adversaries, as you would expect between a government and organized crime. But in other places, they had treaties, they had collaboration, and there was a morphing in some of the governments, the state and local governments, in in where they became the criminal enterprises, and they would have varying types of relationships with the traditional organized crime. But sometimes they were the criminal enterprises themselves. They were stealing public money. They were using police forces as death squads. They were doing all kinds of criminal activity, but with the forces of the government. And that was something much more extreme than anything that had been seen under the old system.
So as we mentioned earlier, Rahina didn't really cover the cartel. She didn't cover that criminal aspect in her work. She focused on the government and covering corruption with this social justice lens. Did she realize how dangerous that work would be, even if she was steering clear of the cartels, given the interplay that you explain?
She knew. She was very smart and very self-aware. She understood her terrain probably better than anyone. And she knew that covering drug cartels could get you in trouble. And that's why she avoided that subject. She did not investigate drug cartels. She did write about drug cartels because it was the breaking news and you had to if you were in that environment. But she didn't do investigations on the drug cartels. Her investigations traditionally were on government malfeasance in terms of misspending of funds, not allocating supplies to people who needed them, and government abuses of these vulnerable groups of people that I mentioned before, you know, in terms of land disputes, the government confiscating land and the government cracking down on various protests and the government not providing services where they were supposed to be. So that was initially her focus. But as the government became more criminally involved, her coverage of the government started to touch those issues as well. And that's where it became much more dangerous. And she did realize, in fact, as Jorge mentioned, they had a conversation where she did realize how dangerous it was getting. And she did say to Proceso, I will cover some of these topics, you know, as breaking news in the day-to-day, but please do not assign me to investigate them. It's become too dangerous.
Catherine, one of the crucial characters in your book is a man named Reynaldo Escobar Perez. He was the Attorney General of Veracruz at the time of Rahina's murder. On the campaign trail, like here in 2011, he was a man who promised justice.
Estamos aquí para procurar justicia, para investigar, para recabar pruebas.
We are here to seek justice, to investigate, to collect evidence, and to punish those who deserve it for violating the rule of law and the new rules that govern the coexistence of Veracruz citizens all over our state, he said. But, Catherine, that's not what he offered exactly, was it?
Well, Rahina wrote several stories about him. Throughout his political career, he had been the mayor of Jalapa before he became the attorney general. And again, her stories were more about misconduct within the government, missing funds, misspent funds. But in these later years, running up to 2012, the state of Veracruz became overrun by drug cartels, and there were warring drug cartels, and there was a huge outbreak of violence. And the attorney general, who obviously is the top cop of the state, was really not doing a whole lot to fight the cartels. And so there were sometimes leaked testimony of protected witnesses saying that he was allowing the drug cartels to take over the state. Obviously, nothing was ever proven, and the witnesses were not named because they were protected. But there were various leaks of reports over these years when he was when he was the, actually before he was Attorney General, he was the second in command to the previous governor, Fidel Herrera. He was the person who was charged with running the state day to day when all these organized crime problems just exploded in the state. And so there were various leaks of information, investigations tying him or other political characters to this criminal activity or explosion of criminal activity, but nothing was ever proven.
And you call this that third rail when these two things combined. What did Regina write about this?
Well, Regina, at the time of her death, again, she was following her usual path of coverage. And one of the last stories she did for Proceso, one of the larger pieces she did, was about the finances of the new governor, Javier Duarte. And Reynaldo Escobar was the attorney general under Javier Duarte. And she had consistently written over three administrations about how the numbers in the state government budget never added up. And she was always trying to find out where that money was going. And we now know in the case of Javier Duarte that it was going, he's currently serving a jail term for stealing public money and laundering money. And he and so it was found out after her death that it was being funneled to individuals' pockets, or at least those were the accusations, and some people were prosecuted for that. But she was on the trail of that and on the trail of some other things that perhaps in her mind didn't have a connection, but actually did.
As you mentioned, Catherine, the governor of Veracruz at the time of Regina's death was Javier Duarte. He wasn't a fan of the free press. Even at a Press Freedom Day reception held by journalists in 2015, as reporters in his state were being murdered, he took the time to attack them.
Pórtense bien, por favor. Se los pido. Vienen tiempos difíciles.
He's saying, behave yourselves, and accuses journalists of having links to the underworld. He says, we're going to shake the tree and many bad apples are going to fall out. But as you mentioned, Catherine, it was Duarte himself who was, in fact, the criminal, right?
Exactly.
Go ahead.
He was under his 6-year term. There were literally billions in public funds stolen from the state of Veracruz, and also thousands of people who were disappeared. That was one of the tactics of both the organized crime and the government, was to disappear their rivals and disappear anyone who dared to speak out against what was going on.
So, Catherine, do you come to a clear conclusion as to who killed Regina?
Well, there is some new reporting as a result of my investigation. I did find out that she did tell someone what she was working on. The big question in the book and the big question for a lot of people in this case is, what was she working on? Because there was nothing in the run-up to her death that could be pinpointed as something that would be killed, that would get her killed. There was nothing published by her in the run-up to her death. And so my conclusion almost right away was it was something she was working on. It was something that somebody did not want to get published. And there were a lot of different theories, a lot of different roads I went down trying to find out what that was. And in the end, I did find out that she had mentioned to a colleague some very sensitive and dangerous information that she had received from sources that could potentially tie some politicians to organized crime. and that she had received this information and that she was indeed investigating it. And that's something that hadn't come out before in the investigation, because it directly targeted politicians potentially involved with organized crime.
Mm. Catherine, in researching and writing this book, did you yourself ever feel in danger, or even as the bureau chief in Mexico City?
I can't say directly that I did, but we had pretty serious security protocols to avoid those kinds of situations and to help reporters who found themselves in any kind of precarious information or situation, pardon. And so we followed those protocols. The people who really were in danger and the bravest journalists were the ones in their local hometowns, their local states, who continued doing this this kind of work, even though it was very dangerous.
Catherine Corcoran, stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're focusing on Mexico, the most dangerous place in the world for journalists. I'm speaking with Catherine Corcoran, author of a new book about the murder of one journalist in particular, Regina Martinez, who was murdered in 2012. She's the author of In the Mouth of the Wolf, A Murder, A Cover-Up, and the True Cost of Silencing the Press. We've been talking about the complacency and the collusion between governments and cartels, which allows journalists like Regina Martinez to be killed with impunity. We heard earlier from Jorge Carrasco, who was Regina's editor at the time she was killed. He's now editor-in-chief of Proceso, one of Mexico's most well-respected national magazines. Jorge says staying safe as a journalist in Mexico means being judicious about what you cover and what you don't cover.
What I say to my colleagues is that we are no policemen. We are journalists. So we have to talk about issues on general interest, but not issues that the police had to work on. So it's difficult to say, but it's a way to gain safe in Mexico.
It's made even harder by the fact that they're under attack from their own government.
I want to be clear about how the Mexican government is creating a background so adverse to work as a journalist in Mexico. We have the official speech talking all the days about the bad press, the bad guys of the press. You know, the guys of the press are opposite to the government, which means that they are liars, and that is very difficult to work.
The government often accuses journalists of being unprofessional and corrupt and of having links to the cartels. Jorge acknowledges there's some truth to some of those claims.
It's so difficult to me to talk about this, but it's true. Talking about Mexico City, or another big cities like Monterrey and Guadalajara. I'm talking about the three largest cities in Mexico. Yes, you have professional media organization as a business, and also in other cities of the country. But at the local, very local media is, I'm so sorry to say that most of them are no professionals.
In places riddled with corruption, journalists can find it hard to stay on the straight and narrow.
It's too easy to be trapped between corruption or a kind of arrangement with the criminal organization. I don't know. It's so difficult. But also at the same time, I believe that there are very local journalists that they are very compromising with the truth. So it's really so difficult to distinguish.
Jorge Carrasco, he's the editor of the Mexican political magazine Proceso. So, Catherine, I want to step back a bit and talk about the work of journalists and how they do it in Mexico. You mentioned them having to work differently. For example, we here in the United States, we get a lead, someone tells us something, we cross-check it with someone else, we confirm our sources, we confirm the information. But it's much harder to do that in Mexico. Explain that a little bit.
Well, actually, it's not that much harder to do in Mexico. It's just that the tradition has been not to do that. And that doing those kinds of things that are basic good journalism here in the United States puts you in peril in Mexico if you ask too many questions, if you try to verify certain things. And so the pattern has been not to do that. As Jorge said, that there are some people who just take the easy route, which is to publish the official word, which will not get them in trouble, or even to becoming into the employ of a politician or a special interest, someone who will be paying them to write positive news. And so it's more that there hasn't been the tradition, the training, the standards to do that kind of journalism that we consider basic in the United States. Now, that is changing quite rapidly in Mexico. But at the time of Regina Martinez, that is why she stood out. And that is why she was a threat to so many people, because she did go out and ask questions. She did verify information. She did look at documents. And she did that kind of reporting, which was very unusual at the time. And as Jorge points out, continues to be somewhat unusual. Although, as he also said, there are more and more local reporters who are doing that kind of work.
And you say that there are some journalists who take what you call the easy route in reporting the government line, as opposed to digging deeper. But wasn't that also the safer route, given the dangers that journalists face, and also not just for them, but the sources that they may be relying on?
Exactly. A lot of it is out of fear. So there are basically two ways that the press is being co-opted even today. And one would be by being paid, and the other is by being terrorized into silence. So you're paid into silence or terrorized into silence. And there is a substantial level of fear for these journalists, because these journalists are from these cities and towns. They live there. They grew up there. Their families are there. Their families can become targets. And so that's why I mentioned earlier. And again, they do not have the backup that we in an international news organization had. A lot of times, their own media organizations, if someone was attacked or murdered, instead of trying to do something about it, they would distance themselves from that reporter and say, oh, that person wasn't really a staff member, or they didn't have our authority to work on that, our authorization to work on that. So because out of fear, thinking that it would help them if they distance themselves from the assassinated reporter. And so it was the opposite of support and backup. And that still continues today. And that's why I said earlier that the reporters in those local environments who still continue to do honest, reported, independent journalism are really the brave people, and because they're taking their lives into their own hands.
Yeah. So Jorge mentioned that in addition to the, you know, dogged, hardworking journalists like Regina, there are also other people in Mexico who aren't really journalists. And so when journalists are criticized, it can be difficult to distinguish between the two. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yes, that's what makes it very difficult to know the motive behind so many of these killings. Because number one, as you mentioned, there is impunity in Mexico. The justice system is not strong. A lot of people get away with a lot of things, and the more powerful you are, the more you get away with. So you have a lack of a justice system, but also you have really honest to goodness cases of people who say they're reporters, but they're actually working for someone. And sometimes it is the drug cartels, and sometimes it is these criminal government organizations. And so it's very easy, because there are those cases and there are government spies in newsrooms. There are people working as journalists in newsrooms who are actually reporting to various powers what their colleagues are working on, or they are ordering their colleagues to publish or not publish certain things on behalf of a cartel or some other criminal enterprise. And so because those quote journalists who are not really journalists continue to exist, it makes it very easy for the government to broad brush all journalists as being corrupt.
Mm. And one thing that sort of rang familiar from Jorge's comments was the way that government officials attack journalists and sort of place them as, dare I say it, the enemy of the people, or the enemy at least of the government. Talk about the parallels that we see in that in other places in the world and even the United States.
Well, it's a very significant parallel and a very troubling one. When I started out writing this book, I wanted to find out what happened to Regina Martinez. But I also wanted to find out why the most dangerous place in the world for journalists was a democracy. That seemed counterintuitive to me. And so as I was investigating those two questions, the environment for journalists in the United States started to change. And what was very disconcerting to me was that some of that same language that was being used in Mexico and being used in other countries to discredit the press and to basically tell people not to trust the press was happening in our own country. And I had not seen that. I've been a journalist many decades now, and I had not seen that in my entire career. The press has always been criticized as an adversary, as, you know, we're always the bearers of bad news, various things that we've been criticized for constantly, you know, over the years. But we have always had this sense in the United States that we're necessary for the democracy, that it's that a free press is a pillar of a free society, love us or hate us. And so when this talk started that we were the enemy of the people, that we were corrupt, that we wrote fake news, that is a whole new narrative to me that has another purpose. And the purpose of that type of narrative, just as we see in Mexico and in the story and in what played out in Veracruz after Regina Martinez's death, that narrative is designed to control. It's designed to control information, control the narrative, and therefore control the people. That's what happened in Mexico, and the people in our country or anywhere in the world who employ that kind of language, that is their motive. It's to say, we don't need a free press. The free press is corrupt. You need to listen to me. You need to follow my agenda. You need to trust me. So it's either a political party or a personality. And you see that all over the world, particularly in Latin America. But we had never seen that before in this country. And so as I was writing a story about Mexico that I wanted to show to the rest of the world, all of a sudden that story became very relevant in my own country, because it shows you with that type of narrative of shutting down the free press, where that path can ultimately take you.
Yeah. So how hard is it? How hard does it continue to be as a journalist in Mexico and beyond to earn the trust of the public and to earn the trust of your sources in the face of this these attacks from government officials?
I would say it's becoming more and more difficult. And I would say that, again, there, I started out with a set of reasons why I wrote this book. And then in the process of time, I have a whole other set of reasons. I think that people don't really understand what journalists do and what we do that actually is helping maintain the free society and is buttressing democracy. I think the average person doesn't really understand that, yet they see it every day. Every day, journalists produce verified, factful, balanced information that help people get through their daily lives and help people make decisions. We do investigations that show the public things that they have to decide whether they want to allow to happen, whether it's a contamination of food supplies or any kind of environmental abuses or any kind of government abuses, that we uncover those things so that the public will have the information to make the decisions about what they want to do. And I think people don't understand how necessary that is to maintain the system. And because, you know, they see a lot of bad headlines and they hear the what I call the screaming heads on cable news, it becomes just, well, the media's bad. And for that reason, we're an easy target. If a political or a politician or some kind of political party decides to attack us, we're an easy target because we're already the bad mainstream media. But ultimately, the target is not the journalist. The target is the citizen. And again, I think that's what the story of Veracruz shows, that ultimately to attack a journalist, that's not the final target. That's the beginning target, so that they can get the independent voice out of the way to carry out their own personal agenda.
Catherine's book is In the Mouth of the Wolf, A Murder, A Cover-Up, and the True Cost of Silencing the Press. It's out October 18th. Catherine Corcoran, thank you so much for joining us today and for telling Regina Martinez's story.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.